Hello again, and welcome to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and joining me today, as always, writer for the Film Stage, Danny King.
Hey, happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day. Is anyone, well, I'll ask this after I introduce everyone. Also with us, of course, is Nick Newman, associate editor.
Well, hello.
Hello, hello. And a special guest today, joining us for the first, but of course, hopefully not last time, Jordan Raup, the overlord of thefilmstage.com.
Thank you very much.
I believe that was the title you asked to be
called
by.
Yes, that sounds good, yeah. Actually, this will be my only time. I don't really plan on ever. I just want to make a good impression, so.
One and done.
Yes.
We had to get into double-digit episodes before he was on.
This is the double-digit episode, isn't it?
This is
10. All right. Yes. Congratulations, guys. Who would have thought? So I was gonna say
that was me clapping.
Is there a father among us? I'm not that personally involved with you to know. Has anyone got a kid on the way?
Not that I know of. No.
I have a father.
Well,
neither do I.
I was about to say we could amend that. Does anyone have a father? I think we can all agree.
Awkward Father's discussion topic. Important. Does anyone not have a father?
That would be more interesting, I think.
That would be. The next version birth found here on the Film Stage Show. For anyone joining us for the first time, this is how we usually run our little podcast. We're going to have a discussion topic related to a current movie trend or movie news, and then we're going to do a featured review, which this week will be of Take This Waltz, which stars Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen. Before we get into that, though, I'd just like to say that you should search us on iTunes and definitely subscribe. And while you're there, don't forget to drop us a rating and a comment. You know, let us know how we're doing and let us know what we can do to improve. Also, if you have anything that you'd like to say to us regarding our thoughts on films, you can get in contact with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So, this week's discussion topic, a lot of big movies in the news recently, not because they've been given release dates or trailers, but rather because their productions have, for one reason or another, kind of ground to a halt and been delayed. Where do we begin? Obviously, there was G.I. Joe 2, which had a very public pushback, supposedly for 3D post-conversion, but, you know, some rumblings around say that it might be more problems than that. We also have World War Z getting a rejiggered third act, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles apparently getting put back on the shelf for a while, just a couple weeks before it began to shoot. So what we'd like to talk about today are just kind of what we think the elements at play here are. Why are these big films, which, you know, usually would get pushed through pretty quickly for tentpole release during the summer, getting this kind of weird treatment where they're shutting down and problems are arising, and what do we think we can do to fix this, or why is this happening now more than ever? Because we have a special guest today, he will be forced to go first. So, Jordan, why don't you give us your thoughts on this trend?
Sure, yeah. Well, I think, I mean, with all these news stories that came out, there was one kind of connective tissue that, you know, every one of these big budget projects said that they were going back for not only budgetary reasons, but also script issues. So I feel like a lot of these, you know, these studios, they need their tentpole releases. So whether they may not be fully cooked yet, they go under, you know, they go into production. And then, you know, as we saw, you know, this year with Men in Black 3, there was a lot of talk. And that actually seemed to turn out, I mean, did any of you guys see it? That actually seemed to turn out, you know, halfway decent. I never heard, there was no complaints with the time travel aspects, I guess, of that film.
Yeah, I saw Men in Black 3, and I actually really enjoyed it. So,
yeah.
Saw Men in Black 3, and I...
But were your problems with the, because a lot of people said, you know, there's all these complex time travel things that...
No, it's just a boring, passionless film.
All right.
Jeez.
Well, speaking of boring, no, we don't know how these will turn out. But yeah, but I just find these little tidbits kind of fascinating, these stories, like, you know, Disney's Lone Ranger, Gore Verbinski, you know, is under production on that, and as he's been for, I think, at least 2 months now. And then we're just getting news, you know, that the budget rose back up, you know, because it was kind of shut down over and over again because of the budget. But now it's already exceeded the price tag of it. It was originally set at. And I just found one of these quips so funny that Verbinski opted for the production to construct its own locomotives from scratch rather than employ existing railroad vehicles. So it just seems like kind of a waste of resources. Obviously, we can't tell until we actually see the
budget. He's not Howard Hughes. Okay.
Yes. I was about to say, he hasn't reached that level. You gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess on one level, I kind of appreciate, you know, a lot of films now, it's kind of hard even in some of these big blockbusters to get a real like sense of scope. And so, you know, if these trains give this movie kind of a huge, you know, big budget kind of epic vibe that it needs, why not throw a few more million? But on the other hand, it's just like, it just seems kind of a little ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I find it hard to defend completely constructing a new locomotive for a film, but I've never made one. What do I know? I mean, is it just things like that, do you think? Does anyone else have any opinions on that? Like, are we just kind of... Danny and I have been joking the last couple of episodes how much it cost to make Dark Shadows. So are we just at a place now where movies just think they can continue to throw money at weird ideas or just completely overblown productions, and now due to like falling returns at the box office, they've begun to realize that that's not a good idea?
I think a good starting point for this conversation would be the second and third Pirates of the Caribbean movies, which are now notorious for having gone to production without a completed script. And I believe there's a story about something to the degree of they were building sets and then writing scenes based around those sets. But a part of why that's a great starting off point is that those films actually did really well. And I think that Hollywood saw that if you bring the spectacle and the pizzazz, maybe the story specifics aren't so important. Not that that's ever been a concern with Hollywood, but in this case, it showed that you can be lazy and you can cut corners, and so long as you can do it well, who cares, right? And now maybe it is... Maybe now that we're getting to this point where the films aren't making as much money, I mean, is Men in Black 3 going to be a hit, for example? I can't say, but...
I think that Men in Black 3 has crossed over 400 million worldwide.
500, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's also... Yeah, I don't think... Like, with talking about this kind of issue, I don't think it should be shocking that, you know, budgets are ballooning, just in the sense that, you know, they will always be ballooning, just as ticket sales or records are going to be broken, you know? I mean, it's just an ever-increasing thing. I just find it more interesting, you know, like, as, like, the World War Z story taught us, like, they're bringing in a writer to fix a third act. Like, I just, like, you know, that aspect of it is what kind of shocks me, like, not going in. You know, if you go in with a set budget, and even if it balloons up, you know, an extra $50 million, which is absurd in, you know, by any standards, but in the world of Hollywood, I don't think is that crazy, especially if this is like their one or two, you know, a movie, you know, Johnny Depp will make that much money, you know, Brad Pitt may, I don't know, World War Z seems a little more of a gamble in terms of the subject matter, but yeah, it just seems, you know, I just would rather, you know, find it a little crazy that you know, that these third acts are being rewritten. I don't know how
right. I guess what I'm saying is that Hollywood just isn't a place where people tend to learn. There's not much growth in terms of business strategies, and particularly not creative outlines. But when it comes to handling their business, I think that they've gotten lucky too many times now to really shake things up.
Yeah,
I would definitely agree with that. And that's an unfortunate trend. And I think a lot of people kind of saw that coming. There was a lot of talk about third act issues with, like we said, the two Pirates of the Caribbean films. And I think that those movies, and especially, you know, Transformers and other things like that, the idea is, you know, if you can get a popular preordained franchise or an intellectual property, because none of these movies are new ideas. So the thinking seems to be, well, we already have a story, you know, technically. And so we don't really have to work that hard. We just have to make it happen, make it a spectacle, and then wait for all the franchise money to roll in. Which, you know, seems like a bad business practice. But unfortunately, like I said, they've been kind of positively reinforced towards it a lot lately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it seems also like, you know, just with the advent, you know, of the internet itself, that these stories get passed around a lot. You know, it's a lot easier. You know, you can just pick it up, you know, like a little saying could be spread in the email from a producer, and, you know, that can get spread. But I mean, looking back, I mean, it's kind of since the dawn of movies. I mean, at least, you know, Spartacus, you know, Heaven's Gate, there's like, you know, a lot of production struggles, you know, on those, and, you know, for better or worse, you know, things have turned out. So I think, yeah, like I said, this is an issue that has been there since the advent of big budget movies and doesn't seem to be going away. So,
well, that's what I was going to ask. Does anyone think that since we live in this age of the internet where movie issues like this are becoming common knowledge almost the minute they happen, you know, is there going to be any shame that's going to be forced on the studio that will make them stop doing this? Or are they just going to keep it up anyway?
If they bomb. But they would have to really bomb to, you know, show the studios that this isn't working. Maybe Heaven's Gate level bomb.
Well, is it worth talking about John Carter with this? Because I know that they had to go back for reshoots and that they lost, $200 million?
But that's Disney. They can afford to lose $200 million.
So do we have to bankrupt the studio again, speaking of Heaven's Gate?
Like, I think it would help.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want people to lose jobs or something, but, you know, I think it's going to take something to that degree.
Nick, you're positioning yourself as the Joker of the film stage show. Between laughing inappropriately at character deaths and now hoping that an entire studio system collapses.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, like we saw, I think it was 3 years ago, wasn't it, where the Weinstein Company was kind of in a lot of trouble. And if Inglourious Basterds did not do well, there was serious talk about them not continuing as a business. And, you know, as we saw, you know, they've definitely skyrocketed back with the last two right. Best Picture Oscar winners and the massive, box office that those brought. Mm-hmm. At least
don't you think those circumstances were different, though? Why they were going bankrupt? I mean, they were just making movies that nobody really wanted to see.
I was about to say, they had completed movies. It's just that, you know, they were really smaller.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, but in just in terms of, like, I know I don't really know everything about Inglourious Basterds production, but obviously I don't think there wasn't a ballooning production budget. But I just think that it's more interesting to take a look at, you know, like the stakes are much greater there than something with Disney, you know, because, you know, obviously they will not die out.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot to kill Disney off.
Yeah, and like these, you know, these new upstarts like Relativity Media and other things, you know, there's talk, you know, when they're big, you know, budget movies, if they don't land, you know, they could be gone. So I think that's kind of more interesting to take a look at.
Speaking of Inglourious Basterds and whatnot, I mean, that's a film that had a definite, you know, mind behind it. You know, Quentin Tarantino was the driving force of that. You know, he wrote it, he directed it. You know, he's the type of person who's built up such a cachet in the industry that he can kind of do whatever he wants. And he also has the ability to, I believe, you know, I've never heard any, you know, problems with him delivering something on budget. And Jordan, before we began recording, you talked about how Nolan gets these massive projects, then you never hear any kind of trouble behind the scenes. And we had talked about the idea that between, you know, journeyman directors and, you know, 14 writers and however many producers and money men behind the scenes, that some of this trouble may be coming from the fact that there's no definite vision behind a film. There's no singular voice coming through. I believe the idiom that I used was too many cooks in the kitchen. Does that seem like another possibility for this issue that's been coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I would say absolutely. Like, if you look at, you know, Inception, I mean, that's an idea that he clearly, from beginning to end, had in his mind. You know, Nolan even says, you know, production is the least interesting part of filmmaking to him, which I find kind of interesting, because he just says he knows exactly what he wants and he gets it, and then there's that. And he even said, I think, with Inception, he came in slightly under budget and under production schedule. So, I mean, it's just funny for such a movie that, you know, with such a massive scope like that, that, you know, that can just, you know, squeak by with under budget while these other movies are just having problems. And I think that's definitely probably one of the biggest issues. You know, there's just, you know, like John Liebsman, who he just seems like he's turning into, you know, who's doing TMNT reboot. He just seems like he's turning into a go-to guy to, you know, pump out these temples after, even though Wrath of the Titans did not do as well as the last one in either critical or box office wise. But yeah, it just seems like these directors that, you know, they're like, here's a script, try your best, we're starting production in a few months, all right.
That is very true. I guess, you know, before we end this topic and get into our review, when you hear about a problem like this and then the movie comes out later, how much of an impact does that have on your read of the movie as you're watching it? Like, are you more on the lookout for issues that, you know, you feel could have cropped up from the behind the scenes issues?
I will not lie. When I sit down in July to see Lone Ranger, I'm gonna look at those damn trains and just see next July and just see how amazing they are compared to other movie trains. And massive, you know, my grade will at least change a whole level depending on the train quality.
It would have been a D, but those damn trains.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. Like, you know, when World War Z, I mean, that's definitely going to be a talking point. Like, what is the last third of that movie? Like, you know, will it seem like Damon Lindelof did not write the first two thirds, and then he comes in and it's Prometheus is up the last.
It's all about God and.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how that goes, especially because, like I said, there was a property behind that. Like, I've read World War Z. I feel like you shouldn't be having those issues, but, you know, what do I know?
Well, when they switched, I think, what is it, 10 stories in the original? When they switched to one viewpoint, that's kind of when I knew something. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Anyone else have any final thoughts on this before we kick into our main review today?
All the movies that we're discussing will probably not be very good when they come out.
I'm actually kind of upset about that, at least as far as World War Z is concerned.
Hey, I was looking forward to it, and then I heard that, and I thought, ah, shit, that's going to be bad.
Yeah, because they have good actors. You know, they have got a good director, though he's been troubled in the past.
No, they don't have a good director.
I still have a thing for Mark Forster. I don't know what to tell you. And I'm probably going to be proven wrong on that. But what can I say? I don't. It takes a lot for me to break my allegiance to a director. I have too much leeway.
I'm with you. He's a more interesting director than, you know, I'd rather see him direct a movie than Jonathan Liebsman.
That is very true.
But that's not saying much. So.
I was about to say, you're setting the bar low, but at least you're kind of on my level. All right, Nick, I know that you will not be able to join us for the review today. Before you head out, do you want to tell us where to find yourself on the internet?
All of my writings are at thefilmstage.com, and I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/Nick_Newman. And, no, I guess that's it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing from you next week.
All right. I will be back.
Okay, now I know we said we were going to get into our review of Take This Waltz, but it has come to my attention that Jordan, who saw That's My Boy this weekend, would like to make a brief statement regarding the film, and that Danny would also like to follow up with his thoughts on Adam Sandler. So we're going to go to that first.
I'll keep this very brief since none of you saw That's My Boy, since it didn't do well. But, yeah, no, this is, you know, going in, I think everyone kind of was ready to just shit all over the movie, coming from the Happy Madison group that gave us such classics around Jack and Jill, Bucky Larson. Yeah, and I hate all those movies as well, at least the one of them that I saw growing up. But, I mean, yeah, no, but I was actually, I think I was in the minority for even going in beforehand somewhat excited for this movie, because it is from the director Sean Anders, who gave us Sex Drive, which I thought was a wickedly funny, underrated sex comedy, as the title may suggest. And
yeah, I agree with that statement. I enjoyed Sex Drive.
Yeah, and so I knew going in, obviously, I mean, just looking at that trailer, he obviously is not the sole creative force behind this movie. You know, there would be, you know, the Adam Sandler stick, there would be really dumb 90s-esque jokes that just feel past their time, and yeah, and so anyways, but I did expect a little something extra. Also, you know, not being written by a regular cohort. I think it's the guy that actually, I've never seen the show, but Happy Endings, the guy that created that, or at least is a main writer on that, wrote this, which kind of has some good buzz. Anyways, yeah, so I will say briefly that I actually enjoyed That's My Boy quite a bit. Now, first and foremost, I will say it is a terribly made movie in just the structural sense, and just the basic filmmaking. You know, there's edits that don't make sense. There's, you know, characters that move from one place in a scene in the next cut to another with no explanation, stuff like that. But it is actually funny in the sense that when you're watching Grown Ups or any of those movies of those ilk, it's just, you're just kind of cringing the whole time with each obvious joke. And this actually has a few surprises, more, you know, it's very dumb. You know, there's nothing smart in this movie, but it is, you know, an enjoyable time. I will say that a lot of this has to do with some of the supporting cast. Will Forte's in there. Andy Samberg is not really funny in the movie. He plays it straight, which is kind of interesting. And the movie kind of goes to some really dark places, which really, if you read any review of someone that doesn't like that, you know, an instant turnoff that immediately garnered, like, them saying, you know, it was a low of Adam Sandler's career. And I just don't, you know, if you match this up next to Grown Ups or any of his other movies, I just do not see how you could possibly have that. But, you know, that's what criticism's for. So, but no, I will say, don't, you know, go out to see it, obviously, but rent it. And I really think, you know, you will be surprised.
Okay.
There's my spiel.
A surprising recommendation for That's My Boy. Danny, you had some thoughts on Adam that you wanted to put out
there. This is just briefly, because it ties in with our blockbuster conversation a bit, but I kind of respect how content, and I obviously I'm not speaking for That's My Boy, but I respect how content Adam Sandler is to just make absolute shit, because like, we talk about Lone Ranger and all these other blockbusters putting out these press releases kind of pushing the idea that they're trying so hard to make this movie as good as possible, even though it'll probably end up just being like an average summer movie. And I kind of like how Adam Sandler knows that his movies are probably going to make money regardless and just seems to not care. And I think that's like, I think that's kind of cool, but so, I don't know.
In celebration of Adam Sandler's pragmatism.
A little bit.
All right. You know, I was saying part of me wants to see That's My Boy when it hits HBO or Showtime, just because, you know, I still have those vaguely happy memories of like being 10 and having like the subversive pleasure of watching like Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison, you know, not getting half the jokes, but still finding it hilarious because he's talking in a weird voice.
Oh, yeah. He brings it back for this. But I just don't understand, like, how, what about That's My Boy? Dude, did people like be like, oh, nope, not going to see this one. And then flock to the theaters for, and I mean, Jack and Jill didn't do as well, but for, I mean, at least grown ups. And I, you know, I just don't quite know. There's a disconnect there that I'm.
Well, I think grown ups maybe had like a family vibe that came out on like July 4th weekend or something, didn't it?
Yeah.
And this one, you know, the opening, the basic premise of the movie is like statutory rape, so that could happen.
And I guess coming out on Father's Day was
awkward. Seems stupid actually, because it's not, you know.
I mean, the original title was "I Hate You, Dad," and then they switched to "Donnie's Boy," and now it's that.
Oh, okay.
So
I guess it would have made more sense if they had kept the original title.
Yeah,
that's weird.
It is funny in the movie. There's there's clearly lines where they're like, "I hate you, Dad," and it's like, and then they say "Donnie's Boy" a lot. So and they also say "That's My Boy" a lot. So just funny, you know, they had a lot to pick from.
We know we've got three titles, and we really want to have a title line. So let's keep one of them.
As many as possible.
But yeah, see it, rent it. It's really dumb. You know, if you're drunk with your friends, I promise, I promise you will get some enjoyment. At least the critics I saw with, I guess New York is crazy because everyone else seemed to absolutely despise it. So
a movie absolutely aided by the application of alcohol.
I know.
All right. Well, I don't even know. Speaking of that, I guess, Take This Waltz, written and directed by Sarah Polley, who, was also the writer and director. What was it? Away from
Oscar
Her?
Nominated. Away
from Oscar. Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say. Danny, you watched Away from Her the other week, didn't you?
That
was
and I liked it a lot more.
Yeah, I was gonna ask how you felt this one.
I will agree.
Go ahead. So, starring, we have Michelle Williams, Seth Rogen, and Sarah Silverman's in there, which was weird. that's about it for known names, I believe. And this is a movie about a woman who is kind of like a copywriter for the Parks Department up in Canada, and she falls in love with the artist / rickshaw runner who lives across the street, even though she is currently married to a man who's working on a cookbook devoted solely to the preparation of chicken. Depending on how you react to that synopsis, I think is
they live in Toronto hipster town.
Yeah, that is going to be one of the things I wanted to talk about. But first, before we get into that, let's give our you know, summary judgment on this film, and then we'll get into it a little deeper, and then when we feel as though we've exhausted all options, we'll get into spoilers and really dissect this thing.
Oh, we can dive in.
Yeah, so Jordan, why don't you give us your all-around thoughts on Take This Waltz?
Sure. I really wanted to see this at Toronto, did not get a chance, but now, you know, it's in theaters. So I think they had it was at Tribeca, so they screened it a few months early. So I saw this, like, I think, I don't know, back in April or something. Anyways, yeah, Sarah Polley, yeah, I like Danny, really enjoyed Away from Her. It was kind of a restrained, you know, it's been, I saw it when it came out, so I think it's been 6 years now. So I do remember loving the screenplay, which I think that's what it was nominated for, and the two lead performances. And it was just, you know, really, you know, nice drama. Totally, totally different from this movie, I will have to say. And no, I did not dislike Take This Waltz. It's kind of a weird beast of a movie because they're, I wasn't mixed on it. I was more, there were about half of it I loved, and then a half of it I like hated, kind of.
Yeah, I'm of the same mind.
And there was not a lot of middle ground for me. And I think Michelle Williams is good, not great. Seth Rogen is okay. He's not really given as much as I thought he would be to do. But yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I just kept going. I know there's obviously a connection here, but Blue Valentine, which Michelle Williams absolutely rocked in a few years ago, kind of explores similar issues to a much, 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 much better handled degree, I would say. But that's my little feel.
And Danny, what did you think of this?
Well, Blue Valentine is actually a good way for me to kind of illustrate why I like that movie more than Take This Waltz, because Blue Valentine felt like 100% just trying to get a realistic vibe of a relationship. And Take This Waltz for me was like half trying to go for realism and then half like really kind of oddly abstract direction. So there are like moments where Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen will kind of like be hugging each other in the kitchen and Polly will just like keep the camera rolling and they're like saying these kind of weird phrases to each other that are supposed to be like cutesy coupley, and like it really creeped me out. And I think the problem with it was is that while I was watching it, I didn't feel like it was authentic as much as I just kind of, through their acting, I almost just saw Polly behind the camera just like winding her arm going like, keep going, like let's go a little longer, more authentic.
And it's just, yeah, that's spot on. Yeah.
And there's another scene where the rickshaw driver has this long monologue and it keeps going and it's this weird, weird monologue. And the longer it goes, the weirder it gets. And she just keeps it going. And like, it's so at odds with some of this other stuff that's in the movie that's supposed to be very grounded and authentic. And so I think that was just kind of my, what kind of turned me off about the movie is how uneven it was. But I will say that I do think Sarah Polley is a really interesting director. And like, I like to say that I'll always take an uneven movie over something that presents itself in a way that I know what's coming every step of the way. So in that sense, I respect it, but it still didn't work for me.
Yeah, my thoughts on this movie. I guess I'm kind of with both of you. I thought Michelle Williams did a pretty good job in her role as Margot. Though, here's the weird thing. These characters all feel very written, but their interactions, at least between Seth Rogen's Lou and Michelle Williams' Margot, kind of felt genuine to me. I completely understand what you're saying. They have this weird interaction that they run through a couple of times. That's obviously like an in-joke where they talk about the ways they want to like murder and torture one another.
Very strange.
Yeah, it's strange, but it's the type of thing where, you know, you're getting this, you know, intimate look at people who, you know, like couples have weird things like that. And yeah, while this is a little extreme, I feel, at least it feels a little bit genuine. And every scene that they're in together, I really liked. And I liked the way that it was looking at this relationship that I guess it had been going on for, they'd been married for 4 or 5 years. And it felt real. And, like, you know, there are moments where they kind of get on one another's nerves and like it felt very genuine to me. But then you have the introduction of Daniel, the rickshaw running artist played by Luke Kirby. And he felt like a character from a completely different movie. He felt like all I could think every time that he spoke and when I was listening to the words that he was saying was that he sounded like someone trying to very poorly mimic a David Mamet character, because he says these things that are very spot on. And the way he constructs his sentences is so alien to the rest of the film. And I don't know if it was his acting or the directions he was given, but he was like from a completely different film. It really disturbed me every time that he was talking with Michelle Williams because of that fact. And so I couldn't understand where this attraction between the two of them was coming from. So that was difficult for me. Because when I feel the writing behind a scene, it just becomes harder to engage with it emotionally. And when their romance is like the center of the drama, like I shouldn't be watching this film wondering what the hell she sees in this guy and why she isn't, you know, hanging out with Seth Rogen eating some chicken. Like I should get what she's getting out of this. But yeah, all that I see is two people saying very obvious things to one another. I don't know. It was weird. Like... Does anyone know what I'm saying?
About her speech on the plane where she's like, I don't like being in between things.
Oh, yeah. That was so obvious.
That was, and it was pretty early on, too. It was one of those moments where, like, I was half taken out of it already.
Yeah.
I think as the movie builds, it kind of gets a little more repetitive, where I was kind of surprised it was away from her. So, I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong from seeing it, but very restrained, right, Danny? Like, in style.
It's restrained writerly. It doesn't have a speech where, like, you know, Julie Christie will be like, I don't like being in between things.
Yeah.
But there's some like directorial touches that are unique, but overall it's more consistently authentic, where, like I was saying, this stuff, the Rogan Williams stuff, is very grounded, and then she goes over to this guy and it's like from a different planet.
And I think for me personally, the setting, you said, the hipster fantasy world, like, that was, it really continuously took me out of the film, because I don't know how things are in Canada. It could be like that. You know, maybe that's why all of my insanely liberal friends are always talking about going there. But I live in Washington, D.C., and if I was writing copy for the Parks Department or writing a chicken book or running a rickshaw, I would barely be able to afford, like, a Southeast slum. But these people are living in at least one half of a really nice-looking house, and they all have all the quirky design elements, like, you know, just books everywhere and, like, baubles glued to walls, and I don't know. I just was really, really, it, like I said, it just took me out of the movie. It didn't, like, for the realism of the scenes between Seth Rogen and Michelle Williams, I felt like I shouldn't be forced to accept this, like, Sex in the City romantic comedy, like, these people could never make enough money to live here, but we think it looks cool to shoot here, so we're gonna do it anyway.
Yeah, I really wanted to know his rickshaw. I wanted to look at his tax form at the end of the year just to see, you know, how much that brings in. But
yeah, and, like, just again, his, like, whole, I'm an artist, but I don't like to show people my work, I do a rickshaw. I'm like, that can't be a sustainable means. It gets cold in Canada, doesn't it? Like, are people riding the rickshaw when it's like 20 below and it's snowing?
Any comps rides for friends in a small town. How can he afford to do that?
It's true. And, like,
I did like that scene. I will say, like,
that's a good thing.
Like I said, there's scenes I love and scenes I hate. Like, I will say that it doesn't work, I don't think, as a complete movie, but like you said, there's the scene where he, you know, is talking to her in the restaurant. It's very uncomfortable. Like, I appreciate it. If that was like a short film, that would have been a pretty great one. You know what I'm saying? And there's I don't think we can talk about it later, but there's one montage that doesn't work. But there's another there's other music. It kind of beats you over the head in terms of it involves like a circus or where
one of those whirly things.
But you know, Video Killed the Radio Star, whatever is playing, and it kind of beats you over the head in terms of like the themes that, you know, she's. Her life is going around in circles and blah, 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 you know, and with this thing. But I will say, like, it kind of hit me, I guess, in the third act where they come back to that. I don't know. Like, stuff like that where I'm like, how is this working for me when I'm not really enjoying the movie? Like,
similarly,
I kind of had that vibe a lot. Yeah.
Similarly, Sarah Silverman's character feels like a pretty obvious analog. You know, just one of those characters who you can tell is set up to, like, have a parallel story that will pay off in some way thematically.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus, like, this is probably a very trite, you know, argument to make, but Jesus, like, you don't throw an alcohol soaked party for your friend who's 10 months sober. I think in AA they specifically tell you to stay the hell away from people like that. It was weird to me, but I guess, you know, family is 100%, and if your family's gonna get wasted around you for your 10th month chip, why not? Sure. And again, things like that just kind of took me out of the movie. It made it really difficult for me to invest in the story in the way I think that it wanted me to. Also, it didn't help that I liked Seth Rogen a lot in this film. And, like, I was just kind of shocked and floored that, like, this other robot from a completely different universe who runs a rickshaw was somehow winning, like, this woman's affections. It just didn't sync up with me. I know that her character has some issues, you know, being in between things that are supposed to level it out. But it just felt like a movie that wasn't working organically. Like I said, it was very written. I don't know. It's weird. And it was almost jarring how much I was aware of it during the film. It really kept me on the outside. So, I mean, like, you know, if we're going to get into spoilers, I think, pretty much right after I finish this sentence. But just giving, you know, my recommendation, I would almost say, like, don't see this film.
I mean, I would cautiously, I guess, recommend it just in the sense that there's some good scenes within, and yeah, that's my basic recommendation, I guess. But yeah, see Away From Her first. It's weird, it almost feels like she should have made this movie and then Away From Her, in sense of, like, it just kind of seems like a down.
Yeah, I was surprised when I found out that she made away from her as well. Because I didn't even realize who this movie was made by when I first went into it. Yeah. I was like, you know, this is a good first effort. I'm surprised though, that they were able to get all these people in it. And then I found out it was Sarah Polley. I was like, oh, well, that's weird.
Yeah, and also, you know, taking her, I know she's busy, you know, acting in such films as Splice and whatever else she was in. But
Great. Love Splice.
Yes, but I don't know. I just, for a movie, you know, I would assume this has been knocking around her mind for a while. It just seems a little easy, some of the stuff in the movie. You know, I kind of got a student filmmaker vibe in some scenes where it's just a lot of, you know, navel gazing and, you know.
I would definitely agree with that. Danny, yeah. Where would you land on this? Would you offer this up to someone as something to watch?
I'm just so mixed on it because it's such a mixed bag in my opinion, but I'd probably like not recommend it to the average person. If you're interested in kind of, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of Michelle Williams fans. It's hard to put Michelle Williams on camera for 2 hours and not have a couple of great moments. So, I mean, there's that. It's just so
weird.
Have
you seen My Week with Marilyn?
Yeah, no, I really like her performance in that.
Oh, right. Damn you.
Yeah. What do you think of that performance, Brian? Did you see that one?
No, I didn't. That's one of like the three. I didn't see that. I didn't see The Iron Lady. You know, it was the end of the year. It got busy.
You missed two masterpieces, man.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
No, I'm just kidding.
Meek's Cut Off instead. How about that? All right.
Meek's Cut Off is amazing, yeah. But yeah, I'm so mixed. But I probably wouldn't recommend it to an average person. But if you're interested, check it out.
All right. So very mixed recommendations. But now we're going to get into something that should probably clarify where all these feelings are coming from. We're gonna rock the spoilers now. I guess the best way to do this with the spoilers is just let's talk about how this movie wraps up. Because obviously, you see these two people throughout this entire ordeal growing closer together until finally there is the moment where she comes clean with her husband. Seth Rogen has a pretty interesting scene that I think he probably, you know, plays. He kind of nails it. He's within the black. I don't know how deep into the black, but he gets it. Where he just is a number of reaction shots, and then, you know, he tells her to go, and she does. What did we feel about that as a resolution, and where do you think she is at the end of the movie? Like, what was your read on this towards the end?
No, I did kind of love, I love that scene, and I did like, you know, the way, you know, that she, correct me if I'm wrong, but she is, does not, it's not with Luke Kirby, right? She does that for a little bit, and then moves on, right? The Daniel character, the rickshaw guy. That was
it's a little bit more ambiguous, I would say.
Oh, okay. All right.
Or what do you think, Brian? It's like she doesn't seem happy at the end.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm talking about.
Oh,
like,
yes.
But it's not like there's a breakup scene.
Yeah, there isn't. There's the breakup scene obviously with Rogan, and then she goes to the rickshaw guy.
Well, it's a bookend, right? Because that's how the movie starts.
Yeah, that is how the movie starts.
I actually did really like that.
I found that was interesting because I thought that the movie opens with a scene of her making, I guess, if I had to guess, blueberry muffins. And she seems, you know, into the creation of the muffins. But like at the end, she's like just leaning against this oven, looking at it very mournfully. And someone walks by her and she doesn't even seem to like notice that they're in the room. And so you feel throughout most of the movie that this is a precursor of her finding this guy, you know, at some colonial place. And falling in love with him. But then at the end, you realize that this is actually a bookend and that this is where she has ended up. It really does feel, there's an interesting scene, I'm not going to say that I liked it, where the camera revolves around her and Rickshaw Man.
With the title music playing.
The title music playing. A little on the nose, but again, you know, it's okay. But, you know, it kind of goes from them first meeting and then kissing, and then just like this weird evolution of their relationship as the furniture in this, again, hipster paradise, really open, you know, rehabbed factory loft apartment, just hugely spacious. God, I wish I lived there. But, you know, like the furniture's moving and like there's first just a bed in the middle and there's just a lot of sex.
I will say, actually, now that I think about it, I've been to Toronto, up at the film festival, I've been to parties and surprisingly nice studio apartments there. And it did that just clicked my brain.
Well,
so there you go.
I'm moving.
So let's go. Let's pick up shop and go. But yeah, no. That scene, I don't know. It is just so, like, for Sarah Polley taking so much time trying to build a relationship with Seth Rogen and her, and then just, like, it almost feels like she just wasted, like, the aftermath part with that, just wrapping it up so quickly.
It was weird, especially because I don't know. Maybe I need to know how this woman and Seth Rogen first came together to really get it. Because I never felt any sense of, like, we've lost something. They felt like such a couple. Like, they must have known each other and been this way for quite a while. And so I didn't get this sense of, like, something's missing from her. It's more like, I just want something new.
Yeah, yeah, definitely that. Yeah.
But then in
yeah.
that revolving camera scene, it was so jarring to see this woman who is afraid to transfer on an airplane suddenly, you know,
she never gets the vibe. Even with, like, you know, the scene with the in the diner, you know, when they're talking, like, she's obviously into it. Like, I'm sure, any, you know, if any girl, well, first of all, any girl would probably walk away immediately.
But
if you're Michelle Williams' character, like, it doesn't seem like the type of girl. If she were to do those things with Luke Kirby's character at the end, it doesn't seem like she would be the one to not act on it before, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
at all.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, this scene is so jarring because not knowing where she's come from and only knowing who she is, the scene came off as, like, weirdly depressing because, and maybe this is just me reading into it a completely different way than I'm supposed to, but she really seemed to like this man, you know, Daniel, the rickshaw driver.
Yes.
And they have a moment of, you know, they kiss and then there's just a lot of, you know, monogamous sex, which is great. You know, you feel like, okay, she's found her passion, but then suddenly you're getting, like, threesomes and just really weird stuff like that. And it almost felt like I felt bad for her because I had no idea if that was actually something that she ever would have wanted or if this guy who really gave her this strange, dirty monologue in a shop just, like, was a nut and, like, this is what he wanted and she wanted to be with him so bad that she was just going along with it.
Yeah.
And then when they're on the couch at the end, I guess it's, like, so many revolutions, but finally they're on the couch at the end watching TV. And she tries to do one of the cute things that she does with Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
And the guy, like, you know, she says, I love you. It should be known that I'm saying that spelled W-U-V. And he just turns and he's like, I love you too. And it's like, well, that's obviously not what she wants. And then she's about to go to the bathroom while they're brushing her teeth. And he, like, steps out. And she kind of has this look like, you know, what's going on? Because I feel like she wanted the emotional intimacy. And she thought she was going to get more of that from him, but she realized that it was even less than before. Did anyone else pick up on that, or am I just, like,
Yeah, I mean, that's the type of thing where, like, the movie, it makes these huge leaps, and it's, I guess it's supposed to be, you know, be shocking, but it just kind of totally just rips you out. And yeah, no, I agree, Danny.
I had the same reading where it's like she's definitely not satisfied at the end, and that to me makes it interesting in a way, because, you know, like things like Brian were saying earlier where he didn't get why she liked this guy, and so when you look back it could maybe be like, you know, maybe she never really did like him, she just wanted to add some suspense into her life, and it ended up kind of like ruining her marriage for no good reason because she's not happy at the end. So that just, it adds layers that are interesting, and it almost makes me want to watch the movie again to kind of look at these scenes again in context.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, one of the frustrating things about the movie is it doesn't, you know, not that everything needs to be explained, but it doesn't really take you inside of her mind in the sense, like, you know, if I was divorcing, you know, if I was breaking apart from my husband, I would probably want to, it didn't seem like she wanted a relationship from those scenes. It seemed like she wanted to be single and have, you know, willy-nilly sex with everyone. And so I just feel like I wanted to kind of get in her head more, and that scene totally undercut anything that I could have got, because, you know, just jumping right to that, it just felt very written in a sense, like, I'm just going to make this character do this, but, you know, people probably want to do this.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. You know, you have this character who you've grown and you think you know who they are. And then this scene comes along and you're just like, well, I don't know if I've been reading them wrong and suddenly I'm Seth Rogen, or if, you know, this is just something bad and I should be feeling like this is a, you know, the she reached her climax, she reached the pinnacle, and now this is all downfall. I know, like, it's weird.
Literally.
Because, yeah. poor choice of words. But it's weird because, you know, you have your own assumptions. You come into this movie thinking, like, obviously she's looking for some kind of love and she thinks she's found it with this guy. They make this weird romantic plan where, like, she just wants to kiss him after, like, 30 years. of being married because she thinks she'll have earned it then, which is, I don't know, strange.
That's another, yeah, that's another writerly moment.
Yeah. But so, you know, you have things like that where it seems like she really is like just looking for this chaste, like heartfelt romance. And now suddenly this scene comes along and I kept thinking, it's like, well, am I just like putting in some kind of like prudish reading because maybe I'm too conservative? Is this what she actually wanted? And those are questions that are fine, but I feel like it's a betrayal to the character that I've come to feel like I know about and I've been caring about, because now I have to wonder if everything that I've been thinking is wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. I like to know who I just spent 2 hours watching and caring about. Yeah.
Also, it's odd this movie comes out the day before I get married, so that was interesting just to watch. It's on VOD now, but theatrically, so.
Yeah, it's coming out the 29th, is it?
Yeah, yeah. That and Magic Mike, two great movies to watch. You know, I might do a double feature before the ceremony, so.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's fantastic. It really fits in with the theme. But yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of what else we could talk about, because that scene really did, to me, feel like the centerpiece of the film.
Yeah.
Where some catharsis should have come together.
Yeah, like I said, I got more catharsis during the circus, whatever, twirlabob,
twirlabob,
whatever.
Well, what did you think about that with her riding it alone at the end and, you know, smiling? Because correct me if I'm wrong, I think there are three scenes of that twirlabob. That's a good enough word. The first is her and Rickshaw Man. And they're, you know, riding it and having fun. And, you know, they're getting close but not doing anything. And then another one is them. They're on it again, correct? And they just kind of seem a little disconcerted, like not enjoying it as much. And then finally it's her at the end,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm not misremembering that. And her at the end alone, and she's like smiling wholeheartedly and everything's fine. Like, what did you read into that, anyone?
I guess that the way I kind of read it is that she maybe isn't meant for a relationship, because there was clearly not much wrong with her relationship with Seth Rogen, but she kind of used this guy as a way to mess that up. And then in the end, that guy wasn't good enough either. So it was kind of like, it was like a mini epiphany for her that maybe that's where she belongs on her twirlabob.
Yeah, she needs that song to
twirlabob for life.
Twirlabob for life.
You know what she should, because I think in Toronto, every job pays the same, it seems like. So so she should just become, you know,
a
an operator.
Operator.
And, good living.
Yeah.
If you can make a lot of money just running a rickshaw around, can you imagine like how much you'd make being a twirlabob operator? Good Lord.
This was all about the economics of Toronto. That is that was the backdrop of this
movie. Really was like a tourist film for Toronto. Just like, come to Toronto. Like, you can walk literally everywhere. And if you can't walk, your next door neighbor will ride you there in a rickshaw for free.
Yes. And you can have attractive men seduce you in diners, and you can go. Oh, what did you guys think of the scene, any scene involving a pool?
Any scene involving
a pool? Oh, yeah.
I kind of like how Sarah
I like pool like scenes in general.
Yeah, just like the nonchalant nudity aspect, you know, because people are just like, I don't think, you know, it's just nice to see kind of, you know, in a movie where that would be like that. And,
you know, I think that shower scene was actually, that was like Sarah Silverman's only kind of meaningful scene. Everything else she did felt like, okay, we need a supporting character here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt the same way about that. Dealing with water. Every morning, Michelle Williams takes a shower, and Seth Rogen douses her with cold water. And
that was awesome.
She for some reason doesn't realize that this is coming from a source other than the shower, which, you know, I can get around that. You know, whatever. Like, what did you think about like his reveal and his statement about like that being something that he had been doing, and he thought it would be great, like when they were 80 years old, to like one day tell her that?
Yeah, I think she's really dumb. If he has done that, I mean, let's just do the math. At least 1,200 times. You know, really, like. You're not, anyways.
Yeah,
you're not going to call any sort of stupor or landlord. no, but I mean, like, that's the type of thing where, like that, and with, you know, with the talking scene, with the the death, you know, how I'll kill you scene. It's like a somewhat good idea on paper, but it's just a little too over the top. But I did draw out things from both of those scenes where, you know, maybe I don't do that every day, but yes, I've done that to, you know, my fiance, you know, and we have a good laugh. But I think it's like, the movie likes to have these big ideas, like, you know, revealing, you know, down the road, that, you know, like the one where 8 years old, where it's just like, you know, it takes away from the realistic vibe that it tries.
It does take away from the realistic vibe, but I guess that was another thing where I was just like, again, I was on his side.
Yeah.
It was so weird too, because like, this is a movie, most of these movies try to make you understand the conflict. And again, I don't know if it's just because of the actor or, you know, the writing, or maybe I wasn't actually ever supposed to like him, but I just could not understand what the appeal was of a rickshaw guy. Like, you've got this guy who, again, speaks in like these very weird, abstract, like on the nose things. He's like, there was a point where she's at the lake and he's like, I want to spend a day with you, like out in the world. Like, can we do that? Who talks like that? Like, it's this, I was like, that's so obvious that what you're saying, writer behind the scenes, like, this is, it was so strange to me. And I keep coming back to this just because, like, that is like a movie killer for me in this film in particular. Like, if I could just understand this guy and where he's coming from, and like, where, what kind of child grows into this person?
Yeah.
It was just like so obvious, like almost romantic novel, like just dead on dialogue. It's so weird.
We need to take this waltz the early years just to see how the hell they got to where they're at now.
Before Take This Waltz.
Yeah. Directed by Ridley Scott.
Directed exactly. by Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott needs to tell us where that rickshaw came from. Any final thoughts on this film? Any themes or ideas that we didn't pick up on that we'd like to talk about before we get into what's coming to us next week?
I'll just say that if we ever go to Toronto Film Festival, we are all taking a film stage rickshaw ride, and we're going to enjoy the hell of it. No, I will say that, this movie, like I said before, I think just a mixed bag of stuff. And it's messy and at times, but also really focused at times. Just like I said, it's all ends of the spectrum. I don't know. It's hard.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I'm pretty sure that anyone listening can tell how frustrated I am by this film.
Well, in the good sense, I mean, maybe, you know, I've talked to people that loved it, but, you know, just because, you know. So I will say it is better. I mean, we see so many kind of, and this, I would not say this is a romantic comedy at all. I guess a romantic drama would be more apt, but much more mishandled in this movie, I would say.
Yes.
You know, come in. So I will say for that, Sarah Polley, you
but
know.
That's almost even more infuriating, is that I feel a steady hand behind the scenes. This doesn't feel like a movie that got away from her. Hey.
Oh, yeah, that's true also.
It's
yeah.
like she knew what she wanted, and yet it still felt weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, so
that's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. It would be great to talk to someone who undeservedly loved this film. So if you're listening and you did, please email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com and let us know what you thought, because
someone, I won't let the cat out of the bag, but our one of our main reviewers, Jack Giroux, said he will not be shocked if this movie is in his top 10 of the year at the end of the year. So, I hung out with him this weekend. I should have asked why, but hopefully we'll get an answer. He should have been on the podcast. Damn it.
Yeah, we should have gotten him on here and figure it out.
No. It's on VOD, so you can see it now, and I think it comes out June 29th.
Yep, and I say don't take a look. Everyone else gives a reserved kind of recommendation, so make of that what you will. Now is the time in our podcast where we give you a look ahead to the movies that are coming out in theaters and on DVD, and then we'll also give you our kind of out-of-the-way random suggestions. So, beginning on Tuesday, we will have some DVD releases. Chief among them, Project X, the found footage party movie. Big Miracle, about a couple of whales. Wanderlust, about some yuppies finding their natural life. And Jeff Who Lives at Home, which is about a guy who goes out and is looking for signs from the universe as to what he should do with his life. I have seen only one of those films. It was Jeff Who Lives at Home. And I gotta say that I don't think I need to see the other ones, because I really enjoyed Jeff Who Lives at Home, and I would definitely see it again. Jordan and Danny, do you have any opinions on those movies that are coming out?
Yeah, I've seen all four. And also another movie I can briefly touch on that comes out on Blu-ray is The FP, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible movie that somehow the geek crowd got a hold of and somehow loves, because it's being released by Alamo Drafthouse. It takes place in the future where these two rival gangs fight in a dance fight video game. And it's actually a fight to their death. And the director is the cinematographer of the Crank movies. And it's just mindless, mind-numbing boredom. And unfunny jokes. There's one character who provides one laugh in one scene, and then really that's it.
Good lord.
Yeah, I saw it.
Is this positioned as a comedy?
Yeah, yeah. It's bad. Not good. It's really bad. That's all. I really don't want to talk about it anymore. and then, yeah, no, I saw Big Miracle is super boring. That's all. It's really by the numbers, generic. If you need a family movie to watch, it might be perfect because nothing inoffensive happens in it for the whole, or interesting rather. For the
I was whole about run. To say nothing inoffensive, so that entire movie is just offensive as hell.
Oh yeah, sorry, nothing offensive at all. It's just such a sugar-coated movie. And then Wanderlust, very funny. I thought underrated. Really didn't do well at the box office. Not as good as David Wayne's other films, but you know, his wacky characters are there. And you know, yeah, good. And then I feel like I'm taking up the whole time, but I'll just briefly talk about Project X. I had a lot of fun with this movie. Anyone else see it?
I did not. No.
It's not. It's more so a stressful movie than a funny movie. Because for me, it's like it's pure stupidity in the sense of, you know, throwing this party and you know, the craziest party in the world. But they kind of get that vibe in a not a cheesy way of just like going absolutely insane and doing despicable things with no repercussions at all. And so, you know, throw it on if you're having a party in the background. I say like you will it for That's My Boy later on. It's actually similar reactions. A lot of critics hated both. That's kind of funny. I guess I'm just a demented individual.
You're still a kid at heart.
Yeah. And then Jeff Lewis at Home. I was kind of shocked at the response to this. I saw this at Toronto and thought it was okay. I really disliked the Susan Sarandon storyline. It just felt really forced. But I do agree that it has some heart to it. I just don't get the kind of overwhelming response when it first came out or when it first got a theatrical release. It felt also a little like the Duplass brothers were trying to achieve something a little bigger. And while the third act has like kind of hits that vibe a little, it just kind of felt too much of like I don't know. There wasn't a lot of focus in the direction, I thought. I don't know. That's just me. But yeah.
All right. And Danny, what do you think is the best bet on DVD?
I've seen Wanderlust and Jeff Who Lives at Home. Wanderlust has an amazing mirror monologue by Paul Rudd that is one of the funniest scenes I think I've seen this year. Overall, Wanderlust is probably like a more satisfying kind of by-the-book comedy. And like Jordan said, Jeff Who Lives at Home is kind of really uneven as well, in the ending especially, but I liked it. I liked, you know, anything with Judy Greer, I kind of like. she's kind of starting to get more attention, like in The Descendants, I liked her in that.
And then
Carrie, yeah. I actually just watched Carrie the other week. It's a really good movie.
Neither of you watch Archer, do you? Oh, no. she's fantastic as this completely
insane.
Yeah,
she is. She's one of the voices.
Yeah. Moving on from that, though, we have three big theatrical releases. We have Brave, Pixar's newest, which is their first female protagonist. So that's notable for that. We also have Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, directed by Timur Bekmambetov, who did Wanted and the Night and Day Watch films. And then we have Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, the Steve Carell star where the world is about to end. And so he decides to hang out with Keira Knightley, because who wouldn't want to do that? Not having seen any of these films, I can still say that I really want to see Brave, because I love just about everything that Pixar has done. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter... I know it's probably going to be awful, but I still can't wait to see it, because I actually do like Timur Bekmambetov. And Seeking a Friend for the End of the World could be fun, but it's kind of on my could wait for DVD list. Danny, what about you? Which of these three are you looking forward to the most, if at all?
I'm looking forward to Seeking a Friend because it's Keira Knightley in like normal everyday clothes and kind of a normal haircut that looks good on her in the trailers. She looks like a normal person. Brave, I think Jordan mentioned this off recording a little bit, but he said it's flat a little bit, and that's kind of the vibe I get from the marketing, but, you know, Pixar has a good track record. So, yeah, I'll definitely see Brave, just to be informed about it.
All right. And Jordan, what about yourself?
I've seen these films that you talk about. So
again, I hate the fact that everyone sees things before me.
So in terms of the anticipation, I can say I will not be seeing any of them again.
Dun, dun, dun.
Actually, funny bring that Danny. I'll just briefly say that that's funny that that's the one reason you want to see Seeking a Friend. And I thought Kiera was actually the weakest point, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
Steve Carell, really good, really good, really great first half. Anyways, I don't want to go into it too much because you guys will probably be talking about it in some capacity. My Brave review will be up hopefully as you listen to this podcast, so you can see my thoughts on that. And Abraham Lincoln. I will say this: I hated Wanted, and I know Brian and I talked about this briefly. And Abraham Lincoln is somehow worse.
Is that a 3D thing?
What
is Abraham Lincoln a 3D thing?
Oh, it is, and that part actually is not bad. You know, no, like I said, the technical elements of this film are okay. If you're looking for anything else, run as far away as you can.
Well,
wait, it's not a really good story.
It's not even.
I know the joke that people are. You know, everyone will be like, "What did you expect?" But when you see this movie, you will understand that.
It is possible to fumble the execution of what should be a fairly simple thing. So I'm concerned, but I'm going to see it anyway because you can't stop me.
I know a few people had fun with it that I saw so maybe you'll be in that camp. I'm just a cynical bastard, so.
And now that we've gone through that, before we wrap up for the day, let's give our random recommendations, anything that we've watched this week that we think people should take a look at. Jordan, give us something you've seen.
Yes, I have a new film and an old film. First up, I saw this back in Toronto. Extraterrestrial hits VOD, I think it is on. Last Friday, yeah. And this is Nacho Vigalondo's follow-up to Time Crimes, which is a flat-out amazing...
I want to see that.
I love Time Crimes.
Time Crimes is an amazing, amazing movie. Just so well constructed. I could not sing it. Its praises higher. And Extraterrestrial, I would say, you know, going in, I was like, oh, man, like, you know, it's a sci-fi. It looked crazy from just the still, you know, when you go into the film festivals, all you get is these stills and a brief synopsis. And so it looked crazy. And so I was kind of expecting something on Time Crimes level. And I appreciate that it made a totally, completely 180-degree turn and made something completely different. And so it didn't, on that level, I did appreciate parts of it, and it's kind of stuck with me more than most. I will say the last act kind of hurts it, but it's more of a like a love triangle comedy, almost like a Woody Allen. It's kind of a really odd beast of a movie. And so
does it actually involve aliens?
If you're going, I will say this: if you're looking for sci-fi, you will be disappointed greatly. but not in the sense of there's so many movies that come out now that say they're sci-fi and they're not. I can't even think of any now. But the movie excels in other areas, so it's not, you know.
Because I'm still waiting for a really good alien abduction horror film.
It's not like Skyline where they went all overboard. And it's actually, funny enough, this is actually extremely similar to Skyline in the sense that it takes place in one apartment and does it so much better.
I never saw Skyline. Skyline.
I saw it in theaters on opening day. I paid for a ticket.
Why? Why would you?
Nick Newman, a co-host, he can talk about it. We wanted to laugh, and we laughed. And then, briefly, I guess, since we just, I think on Twitter we talked about this, Brian, but... Yeah, last year at Marion Bod, which I watched last night, kind of completely blown away. This is a movie from 1961. I guess if you have not heard of it before, I guess it's about the brief synopsis is just about these people at a party, very ritzy party, and it's a guy. It's another kind of love triangle, which is odd, very different one. A guy and. It's a hard movie to describe because it's so visually insane. It has a very dreamy nature to it as they flash back the previous year in both, you know, just dialogue and also just, you know, in the actual scenes of lots of voiceovers of him saying things he thought happened the year before when they met. Sounds very boring, I guess, for my synopsis, but I assure you, I did not know what was going on. For pretty much 95% of the movie, every 5 minutes you're like, "Oh wait, that could link with that," but I will say that did not deter my enjoyment whatsoever. I was like I said, riveted from start to finish. Fantastic movie that I can't wait to see again and again and again.
Yeah, that's a movie that I bought a bootleg of it because for a while you couldn't get it in America.
Oh yeah,
it came out on Criterion and I bought it immediately. And I've nice. forced people to watch it with me. And surprisingly, almost everyone loves it, even in spite of, like you said, the abstract nature of the narrative, if it could even be called a narrative. But I love that film. And I'm still
such a perfect example of, you know, a film that doesn't need to give you any answers and still knock your socks off.
Yeah, definitely. I guess for me, I watched the movie Shame again this weekend. Still completely blown away by that film. I'm not sure what either of you thought of it, but it was my number two film of the year last year. And it's another one where I bought it like the day it came out on DVD. And I've probably seen it, including the theaters, about six times now. And
I'm really curious because that's a film I absolutely was blown away, I keep bringing up Toronto, but I saw it at Toronto. You guys should go to Toronto.
Send me to Toronto. I will go to Toronto.
blown away. And then I think when it came out, in December, I saw it again in theaters, and same experience. I actually might have liked it more, but it's a movie that I'm not sure I want to buy just to, it's kind of like a, not one I would just throw on the old Blu-ray player, but kind of like Shame in that way, even though I own Shame. I mean, sorry, not Shame. Hunger.
Hunger,
it's
yeah.
It's a previous movie. Yeah, I don't know. But to hear that you got repeat enjoyment out of it kind of makes me more curious.
I'm very weird. Every once in a while, I'll have like a sleepless night. Not the movie, which we also talked about.
That would be dangerous.
Yeah, that would be awful. But I kids, you know, just can't get to sleep. And so I'd say, you know, I'm going to put a movie on. But I'm not one of those people who goes for, like, I don't know, Top Gun. I'm one of those people who's like, well, I should watch Tree of Life again, or I should watch Shame, or There Will Be Blood is another one that I've probably seen close to 10 times. And it's just like, this is not the type of film you put on when you're trying to turn off for the night. But yeah, so I love Shame. And it's surprising that I can go into this movie with this difficult subject matter every time and still be completely taken in by it and find new things to appreciate. So you should check it out at home.
Any special features on that? I know we're probably getting too long, but
I think there are. I have not watched them yet.
Oh, okay.
Because every time I was actually thinking about doing that the other night, but then I just watched the movie.
happens with me when I go to
You make a concerted effort. You're like, I'm going to watch the special features, and then when you're holding the disc, you're like, I should just watch the movie. I'll have to make time to do that. I know I haven't seen any of the special features on last year at Marion Bad on the Criterion disc either.
Oh.
Yeah, I got to do that. What's wrong with me? Before we get into what's wrong with me, though, Danny, why don't you tell us what your random recommendation is?
My pick for the week would be Time Out, which is a French film from 2001. Have either of you guys seen it?
No, I've been dying to see it. I think I've never heard of it, and then I got on a bunch of like best of the decade lists.
Several best of the decade lists. Yeah. Well,
I guess I need to inform myself.
Yeah, I have not seen that.
Yeah, it was the same way as Jordan. I'd been on my list since I saw it pop up. I finally watched it, and excellent movie about a guy who gets fired and tries to hide it from his family. And it's a great character study, but also has a very haunting kind of commentary on the corporate world. Just a really, really good movie.
That's by the guy that did The Class, right? Laura.
Yeah.
I love that movie, so definitely.
Class is great too, yeah.
All right, outstanding. Well, that brings us to the end. I know you'll all be very sad to see us go. So to ameliorate your pain, why don't we all say where we can be found elsewhere on the internet until the next time we get together. Jordan.
Yes.
I feel like we know where you're going to say. But yeah. Say it anyway.
No, you probably don't, so I'm not going to say it. You won't know.
Okay. Homework. Try to find Jordan on the internet somewhere. You're really not going to say anything?
All right, fine. On the film stage and twitter.com/thefilmstage.
All right. And Danny?
Personal website, thekingbulletin.com and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
And you can find some of my crazy ramblings at dearfilm.net. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. And again, as always, I note that Brian is spelled with an I, because only terrible people spell their name with a Y. All right, so thank you once again, and join us next week when we'll be talking about Pixar's Brave. And once again, don't forget to email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com, and rate us on iTunes. So say goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.
I just heard there's something with group sex.
Yep.
Yeah.
This should be a weekly feature where we just tell Nick the ending of movies, and then he just, you know.
He sighs like in anguish. Oh my god.
I've always found Michelle Williams very attractive, but I've never wanted to see that happen with her.